In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling art house.
Ooh, okay.
I'm feeling like a sartorialist who is radically cool, who has an eye and attention to detail, is experimental, forward-thinking, very, 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 very visual, and in fact, a trailblazer.
That's a lot of things, Rob. You're feeling
a lot of things. But
yeah.
I feel a lot of things for today's guest.
You do.
And actually, when we logged on earlier, she overheard me saying that I loved her because I've never even met her in real life, but she is someone that I have followed her career since my teens, and she's been making the most extraordinary contribution to culture over the past kind of more than four decades, and has made, I think, almost 50 feature films, and has worked predominantly in feature film, not on television, which I love. I think it's such an interesting sort of approach, and did start out even in music videos, which we'll explore later through someone that I know you love very much, Russell. But yeah, she's actually known as probably the world's best costume designer, and at least the most well-known at this point in time. I feel like she's really brought costume design into the minds and the homes of so many people, and also their hearts. And last year, 2023, actually became a BAFTA fellow, like got one of the fellowships for BAFTA, which was really significant as a costume designer to be recognized. I know she'd already won like probably numerous and numerous BAFTAs.
100.
It's been nominated for like 15 and also 15 Oscars. But yeah, she's an icon and we love her. And so many of our friends love her. If you knew, Sandy, how many people are like screaming that you're coming on the show.
So true.
Including our friends Susie and Alyssa and Liz. Shout out to them. But we would like to welcome to Talk Art the legendary Sandy Powell. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Oh my God. I hope I can live up to that introduction. I'm so embarrassed.
You don't be embarrassed. You absolutely can. Is it quite funny hearing Rob say that it's all been movies and not TV? You must have been approached multiple times to work on TV projects.
Funnily enough, no, not really. I haven't. And I think, I don't know why, actually. And I think, I've been asked a lot over the years why I don't do TV. And in the past, I was a real snob about it, you know, just because of the size of the TV. You know, like in the old days when the TV was the size of a laptop screen, I kind of thought, I don't want to design things on such a small scale. I want to be seen 20 foot high. And that was the reason, really. Of course, things are different now and TV screens are much bigger and there are really fantastic things being made for TV. So I would obviously consider doing it now if it was the right thing.
Very good. Where do we find you right now? Are you currently like midway through starting a project?
I'm sort of midway through pre-production on a film. And also at the beginning of work on a stage show at the same time.
Wow. So you started in theatre?
I did.
Is this the first time you've gone back to theatre since the beginning of your career?
Not quite. I started in theatre with Lindsay Kemp and with small theatre companies in London in the 80s, actually, when there was a lot of... in the days when there was funding for Fringe Theatre and we did lots of shows at the ICA. Then after that, I did about 25 years of dance design for a company called the Chumleys, two companies called the Chumleys and the Fanshawes, with a choreographer called Lee Anderson. And actually, right the way through my film career, I was still sort of doing dance pieces just for those two companies, although I haven't done anything for about 10 years. So this is my first step back into theatre, and it's proper grown-up theatre, you know, in a theatre with a proscenium arch, that sort of stuff, which I've never actually done before.
Well, and what's the biggest difference that you can say between costume designing for a movie and costume designing for theatre?
Oh, well, I guess the obvious one is for film, we get to see everything in close-up. And in the theatre, you don't, unless it's, of course, it's a production where there are screens and things and projections, which happen a lot. But I mean, on the whole, in the theatre, you're designing for everything to be seen in the, you know, the back row of the gods. So it's sort of bigger and bolder to an extent. And obviously, and film is to see close up and is seen at every angle. I guess that's the difference. Visually, that's the difference. And there's a whole different process and different, completely different way of working. It's going to be a challenge, that's for sure.
But it seems like you love a challenge. Well, I think the similarity for me with the acting, when I get asked that question about the difference between theatre and film, is about where you gather your thoughts. And when you're on stage, you gather your thoughts from the gods, from up, because you're thinking of everybody at the back of the audience. Mm. And when you're on film, you gather your thoughts from the floor, because you're able to have that real intimacy with the camera, which is... So I guess if you're designing, I really love this idea that when it comes to theatre, you're really considering the cheap seats at the back.
Yeah, you have to, of course.
So this stage in a production, is there an anxiety which kicks in? Do you have like a Hello Darkness old friend coming to you when you work on jobs? Or are you at a stage now where you're so clear-headed with this process that you can just sail through it?
Where I am at the moment is about 6-7 weeks in to prep. And we start shooting in 10 weeks on the film this is. And so right now, I'm running on adrenaline. I'm going with it. I've got over the initial stage. The first couple of weeks, as much as they're exciting, that's always the terrifying part where I think, I'm not going to have an idea. I don't know how to do this. I don't know where to begin. And it's strange. It happens every time. So although you go through that, though you have that anxiety and doubt, there's also a voice in the back of your head saying, well, you know, you're going to have to. You're going to have an idea. The idea will come because, you know, no one ever gets sent onto the set naked, you know. It'll happen.
Yet.
So, yes.
Yet. Where do you start then? What do you start with, a sketch or a piece of fabric or?
Doesn't ever start with a sketch. It starts with, Well, it starts, first of all, with research and looking at images. I just keep looking at things and looking at things or reading things and talking, as having as many conversations with the people I'm working with as possible. And the people I have working around me, my assistants, I tend to just talk to them the whole time rather than write notes. It's sort of like if I keep voicing things and I get feedback, it sort of feeds ideas. And I don't ever start with drawings unless I'm sort of trying to work out a shape or work out something technically, is when I'll do a scribble or a sketch. I'd never do a drawing of a costume and present it and say, this is what you're going to look like, because I don't actually know what that's going to be, because it's an organic process. The costume develops and grows with the actor during the fittings. Now, Russell, you know, you go to fittings, you know what happens in fitting rooms, and you know, you generally try a bunch of stuff on. Until you hit on the right thing. And when you hit on the right thing, at that point, then the designer will then sort of work on that and start developing that idea.
Oh, right.
I heard it's a lot of psychology involved, like both in like the kind of idea process, but also when you're working with an actor, you have to sort of get their trust very quickly.
Absolutely. That's what I've always said. The first thing you have to do is get their trust, because... Mm. I don't want to generalize, but I mean, all actors are insecure in some form or another, as are all people. So what you have to do...
Come on. How dare you?
I can verify that.
They are. Yes. I mean, you know, they're kind of looking for their character, and it's our job as costume designers to help them find the character with their clothing. I mean, that's one aspect of it. You have to really get somebody's trust, and you have to really understand their neuroses as quickly as possible, in the nicest possible way.
So you're like a therapist.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of that.
Therapist.
And wow, it's not just dealing with the actors. It's also dealing with the other people you have to work with, like dealing with directors. You have to sort of understand how to approach or deal with each director, because everybody's different. There'll be directors who will want to have an opinion, and there'll be some directors that will say, I'll just leave it up to you. And then there'll be directors who will want to think they've had the idea. And right. so you find ways of navigating that and making everybody feel comfortable and happy. And again, confident in what you're doing.
Well, I've seen lots of drawings online of costumes that you've worked on. So at what stage, and are these drawings made by you or your team? Because they're really adept. They're really like, the draftsmanship is phenomenal.
Okay, no, I do all my own drawings, but I do my drawings at the end, once the costumes are done. They're actually illustrations. So at the end of a film, when you've done it, generally somebody, or when the film is coming out, you get approached for the costume drawings because they want them for publicity. They like to use those to publicise the film and to sort of promote the costumes. And so I do them once the film is finished or once we're underway and I'm not having to run around designing stuff. I actually then sit down and do the drawings, which are in fact illustrations. Now, quite often, those drawings have started out as sketches as I'm working. They have started out as a sketch that I give to a tailor or a cutter to say, this is the shape of the thing that I want. And then I just colour them in properly afterwards when I know how they've turned out, which is why the drawings look exactly like the costumes.
So do you have an archive for yourself of all of these drawings over the years?
I've got all the drawings, yeah. I have all my own drawings, yeah.
I mean, so where did you learn the skill of drawing costumes? Because it also feels like a really overlooked medium within art, because we see so many designers, especially like in fashion, that have made, Yves Saint Laurent, for example, made these incredible drawings of all the clothes they work on, but it's only feels like recently that they get really appreciated. And the actual skill set in your drawing, in your draftsmanship, is phenomenal. The way you use watercolour is beautiful.
You.
Yeah, but I just feel like you've not really been appreciated for that. They just appear and it says your name and nobody's actually critiquing the actual work that goes into these, as you're calling them, illustrations. I don't think they are illustrations.
I mean, I think I can't draw.
Oh, my God.
I think I can't draw.
Oh, my God.
No, every time I sit down, I think, OK, I've got to do the drawings now. And I've absolutely got to do them. And I sit down and there's the blank page and I think, I can't. I don't know how to do it. Of course, the first few are horrible and I throw them away. And then I get into the swing of it. And then when I'm in the swing of it, I really enjoy it and I like it. And I guess, in a way, I have always drawn. I used to draw and paint a lot more as a kid and as a teenager. Before I started doing this as a job, I used to draw and paint more. And I can look back on my early work and think it's much better, that it was much more technically better then than it is now. So I guess, in effect, the answer to the question is I've been doing it for many years and that's why I know how to do it. And if I set my mind to it, I can do it. And I should do it more.
You should
go back to your teens and your childhood. Like, did you feel like you were the kind of person that needed to express yourself through the drawn line or by being an artist? Was it easier than words?
I don't know. I did it because I enjoyed it. I don't think I necessarily painted pictures or drew things to express. I didn't think I was expressing myself. I did it just because I really enjoyed it. What I did do, I'd made clothes for myself. And I think that was about expressing myself. And I'd always made, ever since a kid, I've made my own clothes. And I very much wanted to wear clothes that no one else had, as opposed to look like everybody else. So I know I was a bit of a show off in that respect, especially in my teens and early 20s, yeah.
And were there things that were inspiring you? Like, you know, was it music? Was it dance? Or you know, what kind of inspirations were you getting at that point?
Fashion, actually. I love fashion. And I used to read my mum's fashion magazines. Like in the 60s and 70s, there was an amazing fashion magazine called Nova magazine that was really brilliant. And I can still remember some of the images from it, which I loved. And so as a very young kid, I used to make my own fashion magazines and draw clothes. I did draw clothes then and make clothes. So that, and then obviously music and theatre and film. I mean, all of those were inspiring.
I've heard a famous quote from you that says costume is more interesting than fashion, though. So that must have that realization must have come at some point, I guess.
I suppose, yeah. I suppose I think costume for me as a career is more interesting than fashion, as much as I love fashion. I enjoy the collaborative thing, but I also enjoy storytelling and I enjoy characters. And I think that's why I like costumes. I like thinking about the characters and I like people.
Mm. I want to go back to the drawings, Sandy, that you don't think are very good. So when you were drawing the fashion as a kid, was this copying fashion you were seeing in your mum's magazines, or was you thinking about other ways of making it look?
No, I wasn't copying things. I was copying maybe, I remember there was another you know, teenage girl magazine called Jackie Magazine that had fashion drawings, very 70s, very sort of 60s, 70s drawings. And I copied the style of drawing. And then I think I drew my own clothes on them. I don't remember exactly. And I've lost those. And I wish I had them still. I'd love to see them, but I don't have them. But I just remember doing them.
And have you been approached to do like a publication of your drawings or like a,
No one's ever talked about my drawings.
Right, okay,
before.
This has got to change.
So funny. This is going to kick something off. I just think
they're amazing. And there should be like a V&A exhibition where we have the drawing and we have the costume.
Well, there is going to be an exhibition of my work next year Atlanta, Georgia, sadly. I mean, it's good that there's an exhibition, but it's not in this country. And that's going to be happening, hopefully, supposedly, in September. And that will include the drawings as well as the costumes.
Hallelujah. Mm-hmm. Good.
You're really well known and obviously award winning for things like Shakespeare in Love and like Velvet Goldmine and so many films that we all will have seen and loved. When you're doing those kind of period dramas, I was really interested to know, because you're obviously making them in the 90s or in the 2000s, you know, or the present day, but you're looking back at a historical moment. Do you sort of look at the current time and think how a current audience might relate to those clothes? Do you get what I mean? So it's not just like totally a replica. Is there some sense of like the new in the old?
Well, I don't design with a modern audience in mind in order to please the modern audience. But I think it's absolutely totally inevitable that whatever you do is going to have a modern take to it. I mean, you can date any period film just by looking at it. And it's usually from the hair and the makeup. It's usually for the actual fabrics that are used, the colours that are used, because that's all comes from what is being produced now, currently, for fashion. So, you know, there are certain fabrics that are fashionable, there are certain colours that are fashionable. So if you look at something, a period film in the 70s, there'll be, or 60s, there'll be sort of orange and purple and all those sort of mad colours. I mean, I remember in My Fair Lady, which was made when, was it, I can't, it was 60s, early, late 60s, early 70s, which is meant to be Edwardian, and there was this mad floral wallpaper that's like wild colours that look completely psychedelic. It looked completely 60s, but sort of Edwardian flavour. And that's what happens. Or Elizabeth Taylor as Cleopatra with her pointy bosoms. You know, she's got a 50s pointy bra on. So you can always date it. And then she'll have had 50s eyeliner makeup on that wasn't quite Egyptian. So as much as you might try to be historically accurate, there will always be elements of the decade that you're in. So, you know.
It's a creative license, I guess.
It is. And
dance around a bit.
And it's impossible. I mean, it would be impossible to make a Victorian dress in exactly the same way as a Victorian dress would have been made, because the machinery now is different. You know what I mean? If you actually look at original pieces of clothing, the fabrics are much finer, the stitches are tinier. I mean, people were smaller then, which is why everything was smaller, but it's just everything was a lot finer then. Everything is much bigger and rougher and bolder now. And it would be really impossible to make something absolutely 100% historically accurate, because we just don't have the same resources or materials. And, you know, and anyway, you know, we're sort of telling stories. We're not creating museum pieces, you know, or making documentaries.
Yes. How do you choose what to do? What is the initial spark? Is it the script? Is it the conversation with the director? How do you know? Because you must be inundated with offers of movies and people to work with.
Well, if it's a director I've already worked with and like, obviously there's that, and I would consider anything a director I liked and worked with before was doing. Or if it was a director I really admired and always wanted to work with. So director and script. A script is really essential. I mean, even if it was a director I really liked and the script I hated, or I didn't think there was anything that I could contribute, or it wasn't my kind of thing, I wouldn't do. So it's, the script and director. Equally.
And do you get a vision within like a certain number of pages of reading the script of how you can sort of visualise the world? Or does that take a bit longer to come to you?
I think, no, you definitely have not a clear vision, not a very clear specific vision, but definitely a feeling. Definitely a feeling or an atmosphere or a sort of, I mean, usually if it's interesting, it's an excitement, an anticipation, excitement. And then again, you know, followed closely by the sort of feeling of scared, you know.
Dread. Terror. You've got to do it.
Terror, fear, yeah. No, the best bit about, yeah, best bit about a job is getting the job, and then you think, oh, fuck, now I've got to do it. You know,
so true.
Not going to have the idea.
Talking about getting the job, I heard that in your early career, you were really sort of proactive in a way. And I think it really strikes me as like someone that was just so passionate that you wanted to do it so badly that you just sort of called people, met people, did anything you could to get the job. And it really inspired me because I just thought it was a nice message for people listening who are younger, maybe, or even mid-career, but trying to get a break somehow, that you just need to connect to another person that you really admire. So if you think of like you and Lindsay Kemp or you and Derek Jarman, like there's these stories of like telephone conversations or
invites
visits.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. Can you speak a bit about, for example, like Lindsay Kemp? Because Lindsay Kemp is one of my all-time heroes.
Oh,
so
really?
I was thrilled about that connection.
Well, I mean, I first saw Lindsay Kemp and I was 16 or 17. And I went to see him at the Roundhouse in London. Of course, I knew about him because I'd read everything there was to read about David Bowie. And I'd heard that Lindsay Kemp had worked with David Bowie during his Ziggy Stardust years. And so I knew of him. I knew what he did. And I knew what he looked like. And I knew kind of the world that he worked in. And so I went to see this show called Flowers, which was based on the Genet novel, Notre Dame des Fleurs. And was blown away. I mean, I hadn't seen anything like it. And I was just transfixed and astounded. And I just thought, okay, this is the world I want to be part of. I want this. And then that led to me going to art school and it led me studying theatre design. And I'd seen it. And then he'd come to London a couple of other times and I'd gone to see the shows repeatedly. And then there was one day when I was in my second year at college studying theatre design that I noticed that he was in London doing dance classes at the Pineapple Dance Centre in Covent Garden. So I took myself off and attended a dance class. It wasn't really dance. It was, I don't know, it was a mad self-expression. And we had to sort of waft around the room and pretend to be a cherry blossom or fall in love with the person standing next to you. And at the end of that class, I went up and said, oh, I really like you. You know, you really inspire me. I love your work. Can I show you some of my college work? And I think I had a handful of drawings. And we went out for a drink. I think we went to the pub and he looked at my work. And then we just sort of became friends instantly. And I spent the rest of the summer doing crazy classes with him. Ended up going back to Barcelona where he lived with him that summer. And then called up my college and said, I'm not coming back. I'd like to have a year off before completing my degree. I've been offered work. And then he did give me work and then I didn't go back.
And that was in Milan?
It was in Milan. That's where the first job I ever did outside of college was designing the costumes for a show called Nijinsky, about the dancer Nijinsky and Diaghilev, for Lindsay in the studio theatre space at La Scala, Milan. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but muddled through.
But was everyone incredibly supportive of your vision? Did you feel like at any point anyone was tapping you going like, no one can wear that on stage, Sandy, what are you doing?
No, well, in this particular case, it wasn't me going in saying, okay, this is what you're wearing. It was Lindsay was very much a part in every aspect of the shows. I mean, he sort of designed the sets and had people working with him. He knew about clothes. He designed costumes. So I think I can't remember exactly how it worked because we just sort of worked together and he told me the kind of thing he wanted. And then I was working with other people in his company who knew him. It just sort of, it sounds crazy, doesn't it? It just came together somehow. And I knew how to make things. So, I mean, I was making the clothes myself as well. So, I don't know. I think I was just so lucky to have such a start working with somebody like that who was incredibly generous. And maybe luckily he just liked what I did. And I learned a hell of a lot. I mean, I learned so much for those first few years working with him.
Have you been able to hold on to the costumes you made from that era?
No. I mean, not for him, no. I mean, the costumes were then used over and over and over again because they toured constantly throughout Europe and then they'd fall apart and then they'd get remade again. So they weren't ever mine to have. I've got lots of photographs.
And you were working on a theatre production when you invited Derek Jarman to come and see your work.
Yeah, that was a theatre production in London at the ICA with a company called Rational Theatre. And it was a show called Rococo, which was it was like a very contemporary take on sort of the 18th century, and there was like mad sort of modern versions of 18th century costumes. I actually can't remember what the show was about, quite honestly. But it was very visual, and we made these huge headdresses that were like wigs that are about 2 foot tall. It was mad. And I thought at that point I was interested in going into film, because I was designing the sets as well, and I wasn't so interested in that. And I'd seen Jubilee and The Tempest and Sebastian, and I thought, oh, he looks like a good person to work with. So, yeah, I got his phone number from a friend who'd bumped into him in heaven.
Of course.
Called him up. And he came to see the show, and again invited me out to his flat in Charing Cross Road, Phoenix House, Charing Cross Road, for tea. And that was the beginning of that relationship. I mean, you know, I was incredibly lucky, I guess, and bold for just like going ahead and asking people. But and as you say, going back to young people, it's what I tell young people to do. I mean, what's the worst that can happen? And the worst thing that can happen is someone could ignore you or say no, or, you know, you have a go.
But you were obviously good. That's why these people were attracted to what you were creating.
Lindsay said, I did ask Lindsay what made him take me on. And he said I had purple hair. I had a sort of purple Louise Brooks bob at the time and was wearing matching purple harem pants or something. This was like 1980, you know, what we're talking, 81, 82, yeah. New romantics.
So he took you on because of what you was wearing?
Well, I think it helped.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How did that happen with Derek then? What was his reasons? Did he ever say to you why he was instantly, why you guys connected? Because this became such a firm friendship. He became a mentor to you.
Yeah.
He's still someone that you reference. Every interview I've read on you, it's like Derek Jarman set you off, like made you like opened your brain.
He did that to a lot of people, though. That was the incredible thing about Derek. He was so generous, and he liked young people. You know, he just gave. I mean, on Caravaggio, I seem to remember the average age was like 25. I mean, so young. I mean, it was so many people's first film. I guess we were all cheap as well, or free, you know, that helped. I mean, that's the other thing. Back then, you'd work for free a lot, and that doesn't happen now because it's not allowed. But, you know, you just do anything just to sort of for experience and to gain knowledge.
But his advice was to go and make, like between theatre and starting at when you was 25 and Caravaggio, was to go and make music videos, which Rob was saying in the intro. So what was the reason thinking behind that?
Because it was a good introduction to film, you know. You're making like short three-minute films. And I guess what you're putting something in front of a camera, which is very different from putting something onto a stage. And so that's what he did. I guess that's what I had. I had a trial for a year doing music videos, some of them with him, some of them with other people. And maybe during that time, he was testing me out. I don't know.
Was you doing the Pet Shop Boys then? And
that came a bit later. Yeah.
Oh, right.
I did It's a Sin with him, and I'd already done a couple of films with him by the time we did that.
Did you do It's a Sin?
Yeah.
I love that video. Oh my God.
Sandy.
I didn't know that bit. Wow.
Yeah, that was fun.
Oh, cool.
Oh, my God.
And didn't you work with the Smiths as well?
We did do a Smiths video, but they weren't there. they weren't actually in it. I can't remember. It was a bunch of people on a bus and people, I can't remember. It was like in the Docklands. I mean, usually most things were filmed down in the Docklands before it was what it is now. We filmed Caravaggio in Canary Wharf when it was just like a warehouse, an unsoundproofed warehouse.
I didn't know that the music videos you were making were ones that Derek was working on. So he sort of mentored you through that. I assumed that he'd said, go off, make music videos. Here's some contacts or something. And then you...
No, I did quite a few with him. But also he introduced me to the production company that he worked with that also employed me to do films with other directors. So I did a good couple of years of those. And they were crazy. Looking back on that, they were crazy because you have so little time and you're always up all night. The night before making things, then up all night the night of the shoot. Mad, but really a really good sort of training ground.
And if you think about things like Orlando and collaborating with actors like Tilda Swinton, like what was that like? Because I imagine that must have been a really interesting experience because you've gone on to work with so many iconic, you know, Hollywood level of actors like Cate Blanchett, all these people, Julianne Moore, I think, like loads of people. But I imagine Tilda for me is another like person I adore because I think she's such a individual spirit.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, we started out together. We grew up together. Because it was Caravaggio was her first film. So we did Caravaggio together. Then after that, we did a film called The Last of England with Derek. And then we did Wittgenstein and we did Edward II. So there were four films we did one after the other. And it was sort of like a family, you know, it was the same sort of small group of people. But and then Orlando was going one step high, you know, a little bit more money in the budget to do Orlando. Not a great deal. I mean, it was still a low budget film, but it was one step up from the German films.
Did working with Derek, is there comparisons with Scorsese, say, and Todd Haynes and Yorgos Lanthimos? Is there an element of what he was doing at that time that you go, oh yeah, I can see what people are doing now? Or was it just so unique?
It was unique. And there have been one or two. I mean, no, nothing has ever, sound horrible. Now, nothing's ever quite matched it, but then maybe it was amazing because it was my first experience. It's like your first love, isn't it? You know, nothing's quite the same. It's different. You have different relationships with different directors. Some are just purely work and who you work, you love working with them, you respect them, purely work, and others you become friends with. And same with actors. I mean, I don't have hundreds of actor friends who are actors and or hundreds of friends who are directors, but there have been a couple of directors since Derek who I feel are just as exciting. I'm actually not going to name names.
are you friends of other costume designers? Is that sort of you are?
Okay. Oh God, yeah. No, we're all. Do you know what? That's what's so funny is that people assume that all the costume designers are rivals. We're all friends. We all know each other. We all bump into each other the whole time because we all work in the same places. You know, we all go to the same. I mean, like where I am right now. I'm in Angel's Costume House in London, where I've spent all day. It's the end of the day now. It's all closed down. But you run into people the entire time and we're all friends and we all swap stories and we all swap resources and sources. You know, if I'll sort of say to somebody, else, oh, God, you know, I can't find a decent tailor at the moment. Have you got anybody? Where can I get this? Or help each other out and we all sympathize with each other because we know how hard the job is sometimes.
Yeah.
And I heard you dedicated one of your awards, I think it was an Oscar maybe, to an Academy Award, to all the costume designers that hadn't worked on sort of those big movies.
Well, exactly.
There was a term you used.
No, exactly. Yeah. Monarch movies. I mean, I think it's...
A monarch movies, yeah.
No, dead monarchs, films like dead monarchs. Yeah, it's... No, because really what happens, 9 times out of 10, the costume BAFTA or Oscar will go to a period film. Or a big spectacular. It's either got 1,000 costumes in it, or it's a period, or it's about dead monarchs. And hundreds and hundreds of films are made of contemporary films. And they have designers as well. And they do not get recognized in the same way. And they do exactly the same job. And it's just as difficult. I mean, I rarely do contemporary. I think it's really difficult. It's a really hard thing to do. And I think some people are really good at contemporary and other people are better at period or fantasy or, you know, and those people never get recognised.
What's it like watching other people's films? Because I heard a really funny quote where you said something like, I can tell if the shoes haven't been worn 3 times, you know, to make it look like they've actually been worn by the character. And that would really bug you if you were watching somebody else's film. And I was so fascinated by that because you must never be able to relax.
I actually do. If the film is really good and everything is really good, of course, I can relax and I do just like forget about everything. But having said that, I did watch a film just recently where somebody was sat at a desk with his feet on the desk and the camera was there and the shoes had never, they'd look like they'd just come out of the box. You know, there wasn't a mark on the bottom of them. And I thought, unless that was, you know, in the storyline, which it wasn't, that was little things like that. But then no one else would notice that. It doesn't really matter.
Do awards get passé? Because, you know, you've been nominated 15 times for Academy Awards. You've won three. You've won three BAFTAs. You've won two Costume Guild Awards. Is it at some point you like, nah, another award, it doesn't really matter? Or is it every single time it's a buzz?
No, every single time it is a buzz, I have to say. It's a buzz and it's also a, yeah, no, it's of course it's a buzz. And it's, but it's a weird thing. You all say, oh no, I've got to go through all this again. And I know that sounds terrible, but it is. It's a lot of work. Once you get nominated, you then have to put the work in and the PR companies make you work for it, and make you do all the press and a lot of running around. And then it's the pressure of having to, you kind of have to perform, and we're not, our job is behind the camera, not in front of it. But a lot of the time we're expected to talk and be in front of a camera and do all of this stuff that we're not actually trained to do. So there's all of that. But then once you're there, once you're in the room, of course you can't, you know, it's a buzz, you can't not feel it. And it's like you've been, I always liken it to being put into a race you haven't entered yourself into. But then because you're in the race, then, you know,
you've got to run.
Yeah. And you want to win it. You know, you never sit there thinking, oh, I don't care if I don't win. Quite often, but sometimes there are times when you're relieved when you don't. You think, oh, that's it. I can go to the bar now.
That chapter's done. Do you see the trophies, the statues, as works of art in themselves? You know, because there's real design that gone into them. The Oscar, this kind of knight standing on a reel of film with this sword, and then the BAFTAs, this comedy tragedy face. But there's been real consideration over the years. I mean, and now they're just seen as like, that's the Academy Award, that's the BAFTA. But they are actually sculptural objects.
Well, those two are. There's plenty of really ugly ones.
Where do they go? Do they get hidden away?
I've had some horrors. I shouldn't say that, should I? No, there are some really ugly ones, and you wonder, oh my goodness, somebody's designed this.
But are they nice to live with, statues? Are you someone that lives with them, or are they in the bathroom, or are they?
They're not in a room I go to every day. they're in a room on a shelf that I don't really see very often.
When you need a pep up, though, you'll step in that room.
How has art influenced your life? And if you think back to working with Jarman, and obviously you were working at a time, he was obviously an artist, but like, you know, there must have been so much art around at that time. Has art influenced your designs?
I think art's always influenced my life, even as a kid. I mean, I've always liked art, and I remember being dragged around art galleries by my mum as a kid. Yeah, I'm saying dragged around because my mum had a particular fondness for Turner paintings, which I found tediously boring then. You know, I mean, I always preferred figurative work, but I think I've always been aware of it, always enjoyed it. And I don't know whether, I'm influenced by art and inspired by art. And I look at art for whatever job I'm doing. There's always art that you look at. You know, the first thing I do on any job, whatever it is just go through my own personal library of books, whatever it is. And I think you can get inspiration from anything, even if it's you're looking at something from another period, just looking at paintings, maybe the quality of the paint, maybe it's a composition, or maybe it's the combination of two or three different colours together will give me an idea for something. So, yeah, I mean, art is everywhere and, you know, it's always an inspiration.
Do you buy books a lot? Is that a big kind of
collection? Do still buy books, yes. I still do. I mean, a lot of people don't even use books anymore because you can access so much online, but it's not the same as looking at a book. It really isn't the same as flicking through a book. And you know, I know where every book is in my room. You know, I know where they are inside the book. I know what there is. And you can have lots of books out and open on the table at the same time. And that's not the same as having lots of pages on your laptop open at the same time. It's just not the same.
Yeah, you absorb it differently, don't you?
You do.
Kind of soaks in.
Yeah, I remember something on paper much easier than remember something on a screen.
Yeah, I'm the same. Yeah. Analog. Mm.
I heard in the pandemic you repainted your house as well. Do you live with art in your house? I was really fascinated thinking, like, what does Sandy Powell's house look like? Because I can imagine it being, if you studied set design originally as well, like, I don't know.
My house doesn't look extraordinary. It's got nice colours on the walls. It took me a long time to get the colour absolutely right. I do have art on my walls, yeah, lots of it. And I've bought art. I haven't bought anything recently. Well, I have actually, I lie. I actually bought a painting by the artist Sadie Lee.
Oh, you did the exhibition. She painted you?
Yes,
Shocking
she did.
Blue.
Yeah, and I bought one of them.
Oh, did you?
But interestingly, I bought the first ever painting she sold in the 90s,
way back when
she was really young. Yeah, and I saw an exhibition of hers and I loved them. And I bought this huge, big painting. I think she's called Butch in Denim. And it's blue background and of a woman in denim. Very fierce looking woman, looks out. And I've had her on my wall since the 90s, yeah. And then Sadie approached me to paint me. So I happily did it and then purchased. Well, that was my last purchase, was one of her paintings. And it's one of the back views. I couldn't live with a front view. She painted.
How many paintings? This was in 2021 at the New Art Project. And it was titled Shocking Blue. And there was portraits of you with Sadie. And there was a Bowie costume. But the blue was referencing Jarman's blue.
There were lots. Yeah, basically she painted six paintings. There were three pairs. And the first one was me wearing the blue suit that I had made for the BAFTAs that was based on the Life on Mars Bowie suit. So she painted me fully dressed from the front. Then she painted the back view. Then the next couple of paintings were she wanted me disheveled. So that was the suit, sort of with the tie undone, the jacket was off. Yeah, the jacket was off, the tie was undone. It was disheveled, front view and back view. And then the final was no suit at all in my underwear, front view and back view. And I can't believe I actually did that. I did the underwear. Then I stopped. I'm not doing any more. It's ending at the underwear. That's it.
And what, did you have to sit for her, or was it done with photos?
We did.
So that's a bit easier. Because I was going to ask, was it a pressure having to be a sitter?
No, we did a couple of days of. She took a million photographs, and then she doesn't do the painting from just one photograph. She does it from a combination of them, or composes from a combination. Of the pictures to get the essence.
And she's London-based, and I know she takes part every year in the Portrait Prize or the National Portrait Gallery selection she's involved with.
Yeah.
Are there any artists that you particularly love, like from history or contemporary?
Oh, God, that's a difficult question. Turner. Of course there are. Not Turner.
Yeah, but like who are a few of for me it's Frida Kahlo, for example.
Oh,
Do you have kind of buzz ones?
I love Holbein, actually.
Do you?
It's Holbein. I love the Holbein portraits.
Yeah.
And they're very little. And the colours, I love the colours that he paints the backgrounds, actually.
Yes.
But I love Holbein. I also love Cranach, talking like way old. But then I also love the German Expressionists. Or I love Egon Schiele.
Yes. That makes sense.
Otto Dix. Yeah, I'm trying to I mean, you know, they're the ones that come to mind that I like. Portraits, actually. I like portraiture.
I think one of my favourite things about portraiture, if you go to National Portrait Gallery or the National Gallery, is that you can cast it with actors. You go, well, there's Benedict Cumberbatch, he can play that role. And there's, you know, Robbie Coltrane could have played that character.
Yeah.
There's like, you go around and you can see actors, because faces stay the same, don't they?
Yeah, they do. No, I love that. Or when I meet people, I see obviously somebody on the street or on the tube that's got a period face. And you think, oh my God, they look so 19th century. They look so 15th century. And you want to take them and dress them up. That's great when you find the right face. Because there are plenty of people that have completely contemporary faces and modern faces, which I think there are some faces but sometimes there'll be an actor or an extra where whatever you do to them, they look modern. And that's because of their face. And it's strange. Or they've been put in the wrong period.
What period face have me and Rob got, in your opinion?
That's tricky.
That is really tricky. You could be actually Rob. You could be Elizabethan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think you could be.
I love that.
And Russell, so could you actually? You could both be Elizabethan or a bit earlier.
Thanks, Sandy.
Hard to tell. That's a compliment. I'm visualizing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm visualizing you in the get up.
Ruffs and stuff. Yeah.
Very chic. So you two met through the Sarabam Foundation, which is the Alexander McQueen Foundation. After Lee passed away, they set up this amazing foundation to support new talent, artists, creatives, designers. How are you involved with them?
I'm just involved with them because I'm interested. I mean, I was invited to the sort of, not the opening, but it was a year ago when they obtained the new building, and it was, they just had a little sort of open evening where artists were displaying their work. And I found it fascinating. And I just got speaking to a few of the artists, then was interested in it. And then since then, Trino's been inviting me back to various events. And I did a talk. I did one of their talks that happened there frequently. And I'm just really interested in supporting young artists, actually. And young people and young people's work also incredibly inspiring.
Yeah.
Because I was really interested that you chose a kind of young New York designer when you got the fellowship of the BAFTA, along with a tailor. Her surname's Sukup, I think, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Hannah Sukup, yeah.
And I loved that outfit, that suit you
had.
It was
amazing.
With the kind of the shape. We'll do a post of it. But also your hair. Like, as a whole look, it was just like all about movement. But it made me weirdly think about Lindsay Kemp. It was almost like some kind of reference back to your early days.
I suppose it was. It was a little bit, it was quite theatrical, put it that way.
And punk as well. It was kind of cool.
I kind of thought it was a bit Klaus Nomi as well. It was a bit Klaus Nomi, wasn't it?
Was that exciting to kind of collaborate with a young?
It was great. You know what happened? I met her a few years ago where I chased her down the street because she was wearing a sculptural piece of knitwear that I really liked. And I said, "Where did you get that from?" She said, "Oh, I made it. And I've got a market stall at the weekend. Come and see me." So I went to see her and I commissioned a couple of, it was just scarves actually, but really sculptural. And we sort of stayed in touch. And then it was last autumn, she actually just got in touch with me and said, "Oh, I'm making these, I'm working on these new shapes. I'm making some trousers that I think you'd really like." And she sent me a photograph of them. And she said, "If you'd like them, I'd love to make a pair for you." And I said, "I love them. They look fantastic. Can you do that?" And it was after that. So she made them. And I actually did, I happened to be in New York anyway, so I was able to go for a fitting. And I thought they were just incredible. I thought, now I need an occasion to wear them. I don't know where I'm going to wear them. And then I was told about the BAFTA Fellowship, obviously in advance of getting it. And I thought, what a brilliant place to, you know, to debut those trousers. So that's where I wore them. And I thought, a great opportunity. I don't have to go out and find something to wear. I don't have to, you know, I wouldn't particularly need to be advertising an established designer. And I thought, a great opportunity, great opportunity to show off somebody else's
work.
It's
very generous as well, though, Sandy. That's like, you could have the opportunity to be dressed by, you know, Prada or something, but you're looking for these younger generations and giving them a huge opportunity to be seen on the global scale.
Really cool.
It's very generous. Well, we're going to get into our final questions now because we're worried about time and you get locked out of Angels.
Oh, I am actually. Yes, you're right.
So if you could do an art heist, you could have any artwork in the world for yourself. It couldn't be clothes. It could be something historical. What would it be and why?
I think it would have to... I think it would be one of the Holbeins. From the National Portrait Gallery. I don't know which one, but I would love to actually have a real Holbein on my wall.
Mm. Well, luckily they're open again, so we can...
steal it.
We can go and get one, yeah.
Yeah. Let's. If it was clothing, what would you...
clothing, say? Oh.
It's a special bonus.
No, that's difficult. See, I'm not prepared for that one.
Maybe something
it could be
worn
so
in a
many
painting.
Different thing. No, I wouldn't want that. I'd want something I could wear. Mm. I mean, I'm just thinking of the last things I see. The Chanel exhibition, there's like a fantastic sequin pantsuit. I mean, something like that would be great. Like one of the first like trouser suits, Chanel trouser suit.
Whoa, maybe a sequin pantsuit. I love that.
Hmm. Rob's got a few of them. He can give you one.
Yeah, I've got a few of those. Or I'm going to. You're definitely I know a few people that follow your style. I have a friend called Alyssa who actually ended up getting Loewe boots or something because of you.
Oh, really?
Because I think you were in like the Loewe campaign with Jonathan Anderson. And I actually tracked them down for her at like an outlet village because we couldn't find them anywhere. It's hilarious. What is your favourite colour?
All colours. Ooh, I can't have a favourite colour. I love colour.
The rainbow.
Okay, I love colour. I mean, not just any old how. I'm very specific about shades of colour, but I love colour. Mm. And there's a lot of colour I don't like, but it's got to be the right shades of each colour.
What colour don't you like?
Oh, there is a colour I don't like. A sort of old lady mauve. It's
Again, a lot of Rob's wardrobe.
It's a mauve. Yeah. Or that germaline pink, or there's a lavendery lilac-y, it's a dirty mauve colour that is really ugly. I really don't like that.
Would you ever be tempted to like face your like disgust? Like you hate that colour so much, but is it worth like dedicating yourself to it somehow?
Oh, do you know what I mean? Like, oh, try to do.
Like almost like, because sometimes in art, things that I hated like vehemently have ended up becoming my favourite things.
I can't imagine it ever being my favourite thing. I could imagine using it. It'd be quite interesting to use it on a character, maybe.
Yeah.
Who
yeah,
you hated.
Yeah.
Final question. What is the best advice you've ever received?
Oh, I guess it's Derek again, isn't it? It's Derek said that one should go to work every day with the same excitement or anticipation of going to a party.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Because otherwise, what's the point? You know what I mean? It's you have to really, well, you know, if you're lucky enough to do a job where you can enjoy it that much, then you should really make sure that you enjoy it.
Amazing. And has it been like a party for you, your career?
Not every step of the way, but yes, I really do love my work. And I think I'm happiest when I'm working. So in that respect, yes.
We are happy to be talking to you, Sandy. This has been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on Talk Art. It's a real, real, real honour to share this with you. And
truly.
Oh, thank you.
Another act of generosity of yours for us. So thank you.
Yeah, particularly when you're in the middle of this new project.
And you've now got to sleep in angels overnight.
Yeah, I hope not.
you can find Sandy on Instagram at the Sandy Powell. And we'll be connecting to her Instagram, but also posting pictures and some of the artworks we've discussed today. And is there anything that you've got coming out right now, Sandy, or coming up in the...
No, the film I'm working on at the moment won't come out for a year. The show I'm working on hopefully will open in June in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And it's
great.
It's, I'll tell you what it is. It's called Gatsby, and it's a musical version of The Great Gatsby with music by Florence Welch.
Whoa, that's so cool. Mm. Oh, that's very exciting. What was the last film you did?
The last film I did that came out was called Living, which was directed by Oliver Hermanus and had Bill Nighy.
Haven't seen that yet, so also go and watch that. And we will be back very soon. Thank you, Sandy Powell.
You're
a legend and you're in our hearts. Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.